Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. And I'll tell you so.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how it may not be the gluten that's causing so many people to have upset stomachs. New research from the University of Norway and Monash University in Australia have a different culprit. I'll share what that is. And there's an ingredient in cow's milk that now is being looked upon as the primary causal trigger for type 1 diabetes. And this is the University of Auckland and Lincoln University, both in New Zealand. And we're going to look at exercising is able to maintain our brain size. Western Sydney University and University of Manchester, which is in the United Kingdom. So we have a lot on health and a lot more than that. Then I'll give you some additional inputs. For example, our food system. New research shows how much of a hazard our food system is, meaning what we're eating, how we're growing it. Then, why is it that the European Union is light years ahead of protecting its citizens from toxic ingredients? I'll explain that. And there are some compelling facts and figures and scientific evidence that we refuse to accept that homeopathy is legitimate, and yet it is. The science is there, people's experience is there. So why is it the American scientific community has rejected it? American medicine doesn't use it? I'll explain. Also, children are being educated now in school to accept that vaccines are not only the primary way they can prevent disease, but absolutely necessary. Wow, all wrong on that. And then I'm going to talk about, from our environmental segment today, how China is building 30 sponge cities. Don't know what a sponge city is? Well, you will after this. So we have a lot to talk about on the environment as well. China's plan to run the world, something new, and a commentary on the American left by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. Also today, a brief commentary from Chris Hedges. He was at a recent book conference down in Miami, and he gave a long lecture. I've selected 5 minutes of it that I think is very important. Also, question everything, and that will be a short segment. Part two of our consumerism, meaning behind so much of capitalism's engine, is getting people to buy stuff. Okay, well, there's some things we need and some things we can't afford and some things improve the quality of our lives. No, that's not the consumerism we're talking about. Buying stuff you don't need with money you don't have and creating debt that you cannot afford. And then it all becomes just junk. So that's the final part of that series. Also, I want to keep you up to date around the world on what's actually happening on the planet that does impact us or could. And one of them is the Crown Prince. He's only 32 years old. His father is the King of Saudi Arabia, an absolute monarchy, meaning there is no one that can test what he says. The father is 81 years old and in poor health. He still shows up for functions, but the Crown Prince is extremely aggressive. He's pure Machiavellian. He's given the world the idea that I'm cleaning up corruption. Really? Then you're going to have to arrest yourself, your father, and everyone in the history of your country. Oh, and by the way, while you're at it, the entire Middle East. Oh, and let's throw in Africa and South. The whole world is corrupt. It depends upon what level you're dealing with. And when you're dealing with governments and agencies and corporations working together, bribes are common. So let's get over this idea you're trying to do anything except consolidate power. What's the downside of that? How about a war with Iran? How would that impact us? Well, you've got an ally if you are in Saudi Arabia, and that's Israel. And Israel has nuclear weapons, and they didn't sign any treaties, and they're not open for inspection. And also, you have what's called the Straits of Hormuz, and that's where your oil goes through. And if that's blockaded by Iran, which it would be, that means we wouldn't be getting the oil. which means the price of gasoline and fuel would just skyrocket. Well, how would that impact the average American? Oh, it would be devastating. And people have to travel. Really devastating. The cost of food when you're transporting across America. So we're going to deal with that also on three different occasions this week. But we always start with health and nutrition, and because that's something that impacts everyone everywhere. I've been advocating a wheat-free diet for a long time, and I don't eat wheat. But when I was in Italy, and I'm driving through the countryside, especially in the Italian Alps, everything is very hilly. Now, this was in the middle of summer, and it was in August, and the weather was beautiful, cool at night, warm in the daytime. And what they call very productive farm, the average American would never farm at all. We're used to flat. They're used to very hilly. And I saw hundreds of items being grown or prepared in these small hamlets. A hamlet's generally anywhere from 8 to 10 to 12 homes, and some of those homes have been there a long time. I actually went into a home where it was 800 years old. The home was, and the same family lineage had been there generation after generation. I found the Italian people to be some of the most loving, thoughtful, and wise people I've ever met in my travels. And there they were harvesting the wheat, organic, no glyphosate on it, and then they stone ground it, and then they made their pasta from it. Very rich, gritty pasta. And the sauces were absolutely delectable. And I thought, what the heck, I know what's going to happen. I'll get a little tired, maybe, you know, my eyes get a little red, but I've got to try the cuisine. And I did. Nothing happened. And the woman gave us some fresh baked bread, and I saw the whole process. And I took it with me, and again, I would never eat bread. I don't eat bread. But I tried it, and again, nothing happened. So I'm wondering, maybe I'm no longer susceptible to this allergy. I didn't eat apples and I didn't eat oranges for a long time because every time I did, my nose would run and I would get a little raspy in the throat. Then when I ate them from an organic farm, I didn't have a problem. I came back to the city next day and tried them again. I did have a problem. So it was the spraying. It was what I was allergic to, the chemicals that are used on fruits and vegetables, not the fruit or vegetable itself. So that said, it may not be wheat in and of itself. It could be, and it could also be the glyphosate sprayed on it. But according to two separate researchers at two different universities, University of Norway as well as Monash, M-O-N-A-S-H University, which both are in Australia, one's in Australia, the other's Norway, they did some research that showed that the familiar bloating many people experience after eating foods containing wheat may be due to the sensitivity to what is called fructan, F-R-U-C-T-A-N, not gluten, as is commonly believed. In their paper published in the Journal of Gastroenterology, the group describes experiments they conducted with volunteers eating foods with and without fructan and gluten and what they found. And having a sensitivity to gluten has become a trend of sorts, and some people, it's actually as much as 13% of the population, that's an awful lot of people, experience bloating after eating that contains, or because of that, seeks foods such as gluten-free bread or pastas that are just as good. But now it appears the blame for such bloating might be misplaced. Instead of looking for gluten-free foods, people soon may be looking for fructan-free foods. And fructan, by the way, is just, it's a type of carbohydrate found in wheat and also in other foods. It can be found in onions and garlic and some other vegetables. And prior research has found a possible link between fructan and symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. And because of that, the researchers wondered if it might be behind some of the less problematic digestive problems. So in order to find out, they enlisted 59 people who had been diagnosed with gluten intolerance, and they were each given muesli bars to eat over the course of several weeks and to write down the symptoms they experienced. And some of the bars had gluten, and some had fructan, and some had neither. And afterwards, the researchers studied the records and kept by the volunteers and found that they experienced the familiar bloating only when eating the bars with fructan. they were fine eating the controls and the bars with gluten. This, the researchers contend, suggests that it is fructan, not gluten, that is causing widespread bowel problems. Now, that's an important distinction. They also note because some recent research has found that people who put themselves on gluten-free diets may be at an increased risk of type 2 diabetes. So just want to give you the latest on that. So be conscious of what you're eating and test it for yourself. Try for a week. And you can generally do what is called the Cocoa Pulse test. Here's how it works. In the morning when you wake up, you take your pulse for 60 seconds and you write it down. But you don't get out of bed. On your bedside table, keep a single item, not mixed, a single item like an apple or a piece of cheese or a piece of bread and something you want going to taste. You're going to taste it. You don't have to even swallow it. Just having it in your mouth and chewing it. You can spit it out or swallow it. Then you wait 20 minutes. Now, you don't get up. You don't move around. You don't exercise. You don't stretch. You just lay there. 20 minutes later, you then take your pulse again. If your pulse has increased more than 5 beats per minute, there is a probability that you're allergic to what you just consumed. Now, you do that for a week and or longer, depending upon how many foods you want to test yourself. This is particularly good for people who have, women who have painful periods. I've been able to help a lot of women who've had painful periods by giving them oil of primrose twice a day, vitamin B6 at 100 milligrams twice a day, niacinamide, and getting them on a non-allergenic diet. And they take the Cocoa Pulse test, and sure enough, lighter periods, no pain, bloating, none of, and some women really have severe symptoms. They can actually, it can knock them out for a day. They have cramps. And magnesium of 1,000 milligrams also, citrate does well as well. But I find the greatest benefit comes when they go on a allergy-free program. Now, you stay on the allergy-free program for 30 days. That means that for 30 days, you don't have anything that you have a high pulse rate with or higher than 5 beats per minute. At that point, you then re-challenge yourself, meaning after 30 days of not having any sugar or any dairy or any wheat, you then take a small amount of that in one meal in the morning, just that on an empty stomach. And let's see the symptoms. Now, if your earlier symptoms, stuffiness in the nose, congestion in the ears, mucus in the eyes, pain in the chest, in the joints flaring up, fog in the brain, if any of those happen, then you're definitely allergic to that and you stay away from it. But if you don't, then you may be able to reintroduce a food that you were allergic to, providing it's on a rotational basis of not more than once a week. So that's why a varied diet is so important. Now, ideally, you wouldn't have anything with a heartbeat or face, nothing refined, and more of a living food diet and a plant-based living food diet. That's the healthiest diet there is. But if you're the average person, you're not going to go on a plant-based diet. It's just not going to happen. That's the reality. But this is the best way of getting you aware that, gee whiz, you don't have to have that bloating, gas, distension after a meal. From the University of Auckland and Lincoln University in New Zealand, an ingredient in cow's milk has now been identified as a type 1 diabetes trigger in those with genetic risk factors. So this is important. And let's be realistic. The United States is the world's largest producer of pasteurized cow's milk. But oddly enough, it is also one of the world's smallest consumers. The dairy industry thus has a vested interest in eliminating all raw milk suppliers from the marketplace to enforce an increase per capita consumption of pasteurized milk, which is lagging behind most of the world. And pasteurized milk is perhaps one of the most nutritionally deficient beverages, misappropriately labeled as a perfect food. It is not. raw milk enthusiast, providing that the raw milk comes from a registered dairy that does bacterial testing on a daily basis, they've known for a very long time that unpasteurized milk is the only milk that should ever be consumed. Why? Because pasteurization destroys enzymes, diminishes vitamin content, denatures fragile milk proteins, and destroys vitamin C, B12, and B6, kills beneficial bacteria, promotes pathogens, and is associated with allergies and increased teeth decay, colic in infants, and growth problems in children, osteoporosis, arthritis, heart disease, and cancer. That's correct. That's from drinking milk. And several researchers assessed 71 separate studies on populations, epidemiology, and animal trials, and in vitro laboratory experiments, biochemistry, and pharmacology. The paper on the findings, originally published in the Journal of Nutrition and Diabetes, said that A1 beta casein in cow's milk is a primary causal trigger of the disease. However, so far there's no clinical trials on the subject. And two of the seven researchers, professors, explained, quote, people who genetically are susceptible to developing type 1 diabetes would need to be identified at birth, and half of them randomly allocated to a diet free of A1 beta casein for many years. But we have to look at the Chinese connection. Recently, I filmed Dr. Colin Campbell. He is one of the leading nutrition researchers. He wrote the China syndrome about the amount of heart disease and other conditions that you do not see in China as compared to other westernized countries, and why, and it was principally the diet. And I filmed him up in at Cornell University, up in Ithaca. Well, the paper revealed that the sudden growth in the incidence of type 1 diabetes in China is correlated with the country's 300% increase in dairy consumption per capita since 2006, with substantial increases in going up after that. And in Shanghai alone, new type 1 diabetes cases among children age 15 and below increased 14% annually between 1997 and 2011. And further south in China, the annual rate of increase in type 1 diabetes went to 12% among adolescents age 19 and below. And more worryingly, children below 5 saw the greatest increase in such cases at an annual rate of 33%. Now, why? Because historically, the young Chinese didn't drink milk. And young children's dependence on milk consumption could explain the high prevalence of type 1 diabetes among those below the age of 5. According to the scientific paper, quote, according to the ecological epidemiological data, although not proven causation, provide powerful evidence that A1 beta casein is a causal factor in the pathogenesis of type 1 diabetes. So when countries begin to look at the American diet and want what we have, they start taking in the fried foods, they abandon the traditional foods of their own country, like the Japanese have one of the healthiest diets in the world. The people on Formosa, also on Okinawa, have great diets. On Crete, great diets. The Hunza cuts. These people are long-lived, but today their lifespan is coming down a bit because they're eating a Western-type diet. And finally, exercise maintains your brain size. According to new research, Western Sydney University and University of Manchester, which is the United Kingdom, aerobic exercise can definitely improve your memory and maintain brain health as you age. In a first-of-its-kind international collaboration, researchers from Australia's National Institutes of Complementary Medicine at Western Sydney University and the Division of Psychology and Mental Health at the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom examined the effects of aerobic exercise on a region of the brain called the hippocampus, which I'm sure you're aware is the critical storage of our memory and brain functions. And brain health decreases with age, with the average brain shrinking by approximately 5% per decade after the age of 40. And so the researchers systematically reviewed 14 clinical studies which examined brain scans of almost 737 people before and after aerobic exercise programs and in control conditions. And there was mild cognitive impairment, and including Alzheimer's disease, and people had a diminishment of mental faculty. They also had depression, and after exercising, all those improved. So exercise on a daily basis, and you can make a difference. Also today, there was a study from the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems. Now, they've identified five mechanisms whereby the current food systems makes people sick. One, people get sick because they work under unhealthy conditions. Two, because of contaminants in the water, soil, and air. Three, specific foods that people eat on a regular basis are unsafe for consumption. Watch any of the commercials on television. They're giving you bacon and ham and beef and cheese, and all of this is garbage. None of this is healthy. None of it promotes longevity, wellness, or prevention of disease. It all contributes to disease. Also, we have repeatedly unhealthy diets. We refuse to change our habits. And some people cannot access acceptable foods at all times. So those are the reasons. So when people say, gee whiz, we need more money for more technology, and there's some really heart-rendering ads. I'm sure you've seen them with the Shriners. And by the way, the Shriners do a very good job. I commend them for all the work they've done, and Danny Thomas's St. Jude Hospital. There are some legitimate, decent, ethical people who are doing the best they can to provide free medical care to children. Here's what we're not doing. We're taking a look and confusing the science of nanotechnologies with how to prevent the disease in the first place. We have zero national program, state programs, or even local programs that reach out to people to show here's how you prevent diabetes, heart disease, cancers, arthritis, and brain conditions, obesity. We have none of that. Also, we have no program to actually support people in making a healthy lifestyle choice. Shouldn't people actually be rewarded if they choose a healthy lifestyle and they're able to prove it? Shouldn't their insurance premiums go down? Of course, if we were a civilized society, we have universal health care. But these are the things we should be focused upon: preventing disease and natural, non-toxic ways of treating them. If you look at how few people, and this is never in the ad, and you should ask them, call Sloan Kettering and ask whoever the information director is there this question. It's a legitimate question. Of your terminally ill patients with prostate cancer, colorectal cancer, what is your 5-year survival rate? Meaning alive and well at the end of 5 years with no trace of any tumor marker in the body. There's no cancer in the body. It's zero. So then ask them, what is your cure rate for 5-year, let's say, stage 4, breast cancer, ovarian cancer? They will not have an answer. So I think that we have to get to a place where we start to realize that if they don't have the answer after decade upon decades and hundreds of billions of dollars they've gotten, then we have the wrong scientific model. And we should start refocusing on a whole new paradigm. Now, that's not going to happen because in the real world, no one is about to give up their privileges and their professional income. It's not going to happen. I remember once coming out of the studio at WMCA. This is back in the mid-1970s. And it was a Saturday. And I would spend about 6 hours on Saturdays after doing a 4-hour radio show answering the mail. And there was always a really nice group of people, men and women, who would come, and we would take over the conference room, and we'd have all the mail, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 letters that week. And then we would answer them by categories, if it was on arthritis or whatever the topic. And I'd be there popping off answers. But before I got upstairs to the conference room, this man said, "Can I speak to you for a moment?" I said, "Sure." He said, "I was listening to your program yesterday, talking about cancer and the politics of cancer. And boy, you didn't begin to touch the subject as it really is. I said, I can only share what I know. He said, well, let me tell you what you don't know. He said, I'm one of those people you talked about. I will not tell you my name. You will never see me again. But I just felt I had to get this off my chest. He said, I'm a board-certified oncologist, and I and everyone else follows a protocol, and the hospital's protocol, which means that if you see a patient dying, you cannot change the protocol. So it's the protocol with cancer that's killing the patients. So we just have to keep giving them more and more and more, no matter what the symptoms are. He said, does that outrage you? I said, yes, it does. Because I thought as a physician, your primary obligation was if you see something's not working, change it. He says, nobody in the system can change the system. Nurses can't, administrators can't, doctors can't, because we don't control the system. We have made our pact with the devil. I said, why? Why can't you change? He said, well, I have two daughters in an Ivy League school. I have a very expensive lifestyle. And as long as I do what I'm told, all that's paid for. If I were to challenge them, even if I'm right in my challenge, all that disappears. Now, if you know anything about human nature, do you really think people are going to give up their six-figure plus incomes per year because of helping the patient? He said, that's where you should start looking. He gave me then some files, and he gave me some documents, and I would go on to do a major story on the politics of cancer going beyond what I originally had discussed. Never saw the man again. Don't know who he was, but the idea is that people have been given 100% of our money and time and energy and authority, and they don't have good results. Shouldn't we fire them? Shouldn't we give people our support who have good results and not just claiming that they have a good effort? If you have a terminal disease, you don't want effort, you want results. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest in health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you. Knowing I love you so.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going to go now to a speech by Chris Hedges. It's a short speech, but it's one that we have to listen to carefully because it represents a truth that you will not hear on MSNBC, you will not hear on Fox, you will not hear anywhere in the mainstream, and unfortunately even in some of the alternative media. But you will hear it here today. Please listen in. This is Chris Hedges speaking at a Miami book conference.
The end of literacy and the triumph of spectacle makes the argument that we are the most illusioned nation on the planet, that we have become utterly disconnected from who we are, what we represent, and where we're going, and replaced it with fantasy. It has allowed us to run offshore penal colonies where we openly torture other human beings, suspend habeas corpus, engage in warrantless wiretapping and eavesdropping of American civilians, live through a banana republic 2000 election, where unfortunately this state contributed to the theft of the Democratic vote, and yet describe ourselves as the greatest democracy on earth, a democracy that abrogates the right to impose its virtues on others by force. We have built a system of unfettered capitalism which has turned everything from human beings to the natural environment into commodities for exploitation until exhaustion or collapse. This has hollowed out America from the inside. It's why we are borrowing roughly at a rate of $2 billion a day from the Chinese and have been for the last 10 years. At some point, that has to collapse. We have destroyed our manufacturing base and described it as an opportunity for growth. All of these things have fed into, I think, a very frightening fantasy about where we're headed, that we have, in many ways, remained 40-year-old children, unable to confront as the historian, Harvard historian Charles Mayer calls it, that transition from an empire of production to an empire of consumption. Real wages in this country have remained stagnant since 1973, and just as we maintain empire through credit and borrowing, we maintain a lifestyle that we can no longer afford through credit and borrowing. All of that is collapsing. One strives towards a dream, one lives within an illusion. And the illusion that we are fed is that reality is never an impediment to what we want. That we can, if we just dig deep enough within ourselves, if we find our inner strength, if we grasp, as Tony Robbins says, that we are truly exceptional, if we believe that Jesus can perform miracles, if we focus on happiness, we can fulfill this pernicious psychological idea among consumer culture that has sort of instilled massive consumption as a kind of inner compulsion. And the danger of illusion is that it allows you to remain in a state of perpetual childishness, infantilism. And as that gap opens up between the illusion of who we are and the reality, the foreclosures, the bankruptcies that are caused by the inability to pay medical bills, the collapse of empire, we are unprepared emotionally, psychologically, and intellectually for what it is that is about to confront us. And when the wolf finally bays at the door, when our house is foreclosed, when the unemployment insurance runs out, then you react if you have remained in a state of illusion, as a child reacts. You search for a demagogue or a savior who promises moral renewal, vengeance, and new glory. And we can already see that very frightening psychological disease leaping up around the fringes of American society. The only way that one can speak about hope is to break free from a non-reality-based belief system, to begin to speak in a new language of humility, to accept a lifestyle which frees itself from profligate consumption and endorses a new simplicity. And then finally, it is not incidental or accidental that the environmental crisis we face is twinned with the economic crisis. It stems from the same disease which is turning everything, human beings into a commodity, the natural environment into a commodity that we exploit and exhaust until it dies. And either we wake from this illusion or we commit collective suicide.
Was Chris Hedges. By the way, he was mentioning about the pop culture of the New Age movement, including the Tony Robbins and those people that promote the idea of just focus upon happiness and good thoughts. I'm completely against that. In fact, George Bernard Shaw who said, we have no more right to consume happiness without producing it than to consume wealth without producing it. And in virtually all of my lectures, I believe it's essential to share the idea that show the problem, be completely honest about it, don't be political. Whatever it is, that's what it is. Whoever's responsible, that's who's responsible. But more importantly, then show what are our options to correct it. And more often than not, we're not at a place in our life where we're even willing to look at our own deficiencies, our own insecurities, our own biases, our own hidden agendas. And if we can't do that, then what possibly could we understand about anything else in life since we are already living in an illusion? That said, I also want to share something from Dr. Paul Craig Schaubers because I think he's really on to this. And for years, I have seen that when it comes to alternative healing, challenging the pharmaceutical industry, challenging the cancer industry, challenging the body politic, both Democrat and Republican, the left has almost always universally sided with the corporate interest. You rarely hear a program that takes on or investigates and shows the dangers of vaccines, for example. And yet, for those of us who are actually scholars in the field who've spent more than 15,000 hours of research, the questions are vaccines safe or effective? The answer is no. The question is, why is it that the other journalists in the United States, physicians and public health officials, are not up on it? There is your biases. So we have an unlimited amount of a bias that then automatically filters our thoughts. But once upon a time, the left wing of the political spectrum was committed to the advancement of the working class and its protection from political and economic abuse by the owners of the means of production. That's what Chris Hedges was just referring to. And consequently, the left wing was politically potent and reached a pinnacle of power when Henry Wallace was selected by FDR as his third-term vice president. And despite his wealth from the company he founded, Wallace stood for the farmer and the working class. And I do not know of a single vice presidential candidate since then who measures up to that by any light years away. And the Democratic Party power brokers refused to accept Wallace as the vice presidential candidate until FDR told them he otherwise would decline the presidential nomination. Now, Wallace was Roosevelt's and the Democratic Party's choice for vice president, Roosevelt's fourth term, but Wallace's progressive views, and he was a progressive, had alienated the party bosses and the Wall Street bankers and the anti-union businesses and the American, British, and French allies with their support for labor unions and women and minorities and victims of colonialization. And when he called for the emancipation of colonial subjects and for working with the Soviet Union in the cause of peace and working class justice, that sealed his fate. Despite a Gallup poll released during the Democratic National Convention in July of 1944, showing that Wallace was the favorite with 65% of the vote, and Roosevelt's announcement that if he were a delegate, he would choose Wallace, the party bosses chose Harry Truman, who was preferred by only 2% of the Democratic voters. Now, this was a turning point in U.S. politics, and in fact, world history. If the people had prevailed over the corrupt Democratic Party bosses, the same type we have today, they're all corrupt, Wallace instead of Truman would have become the first post-war U.S. president. So what would have been the outcome? Most likely, so it's not an insignificant fact I'm sharing with you, a little history lesson, we would have had no Cold War. We had had no Korean War. We'd had no Vietnam War. We'd had no NATO and no decades of mutual distrust between the U.S. and Russia that today threatens life on Earth. Moreover, in place of today's highly skewed income and wealth distribution towards the very rich fraction of 1%, there would be an equitable distribution that would support a strong consumer market instead of declining real incomes and debt expansion that threatens economic growth and business profits and employment and high equity values. Quote, Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, in their bestseller, The Untold History of the United States, which, by the way, I really recommend that you watch, they have as a series, describes the Clinton-style Democratic Party. By the way, it's Hillary Clinton was the boss in that arrangement, and her husband was the very charismatic and charming front person, but she was maniacal on details and really controlled that presidency. Quote, Party insiders made sure that they had an iron grip on the convention, yet the rank-and-file Democrats would not go quietly, staging a rebellion on the convention floor. The groundswell of support for Wallace among the delegates and attendees was so great that despite the boss's stranglehold over the proceedings and strong-arm tactics, Wallace's supporters almost carried the day as an uproarious demonstration for Wallace broke out in the convention floor. In the midst of the demonstration, Florida Senator Claude Pepper, who I interviewed a long time ago, realized that if he got Wallace's name into nomination that night, Wallace would sweep the convention. so Pepper fought his way through the crowd to get him within 5 feet of the microphone when the nearly hysterical Mayor Kelly purported that there was a fire hazard, got the chairman, Senator Samuel Jackson, to adjourn the proceedings. Had Pepper made it 5 more feet and nominated Wallace before the bosses forced adjournment against the will of the delegates, Wallace would have become president in 1945, and the course of history would have been dramatically changed. The next day, Senator Jackson apologized to Senator Pepper. Quote, here's what he had. I had strict instructions from Hennigan not to let the convention nominate the vice president last night, so I had to adjourn the convention in your face. Now, thus was the power of interest groups to prevail over democracy. 73 years later, when there was still a press that would, on occasion, speak for the people, David Krasner and Brett Arenins described the power, the interest, and the degeneration of the media today. Quote, it has been my view since 2003 that the oligarchs would hold up the system with printed money and credit creation until every last crumb of middle-class wealth was swept off the table and into the pockets of those in positions to do the sweeping. Obama delivered nothing on his original campaign promises. He was going to reform Wall Street, but the concept was too big to fail, was legislated under Obama, and Wall Street indictments, prosecutions fell precipitously from the previous administration. Obama left office and entered into a world of high six-figure Wall Street-sponsored speaking engagements and lives in a $10 million estate in Hawaii, paid for by the Chicago elite, the Priskers. Now Obama will be paid off tens of millions for his role in aiding and abetting the transfer of trillions of dollars from the middle class to the elitists. Look at Bill and Hillary. Need I say more? Trump has reversed course on his campaign promises twice as quickly as Obama. Almost overnight after his inauguration, Trump became a warmongering hand puppet for the deep state swamp creatures. The media has been willingly complicit in this big charade. Much to my complete shock, Brett Arenins has published a commentary on MarketWatch, which for an insider warns about the media. Do you want to know what kind of person makes the best reporter? I'll tell you. A borderline sociopath. Failings someone smart, inquisitive, stubborn, disorganized, chaotic, and in a perpetual state of simmering rage at the failings of the world. Once upon a time, you saw people like this in every newsroom in the country. They often had chaotic personal lives, and they died early of cirrhosis or a heart attack. But they were tough, angry SOBs, and they produced great stories. Do you want to know what kind of people get promoted and succeed in the modern news organizations? Social climbers, networkers, people who are gregarious, who buy in to the dominant consensus, who go along to get along, and don't ask too many really awkward questions. They are flexible, well-organized, and happy with life, and it shows. This is why so many reporters are happy to report that the U.S. corporations are in great financial shape, even though they have surging debts, or that a diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds will protect you in all circumstances, even though this is not the case, or that the defense budgets are being slashed when they are not, or that the U.S. economy has massively outperformed rivals such as Japan when on key metrics it has not, nor that companies must pay CEOs gazillions of dollars to secure the top talent when they don't need to do any of such thing and just pay to plunder. The American left wing has been transmogrified. The left, which formerly stood for peace and bread, today stands for identity politics and war. The working class has been redefined as the Trump deplorables and splintered into separate victim groups, women, racial minorities, homosexuals, transgender. The oppressors are no longer oligarchs who own the means of production. The oppressor is the sexist, misogynist, homophobic, heterosexual, fascist, white supremacist, male working class. The rise of identity politics has brought with it politically controlled speech. Primarily white people, especially heterosexual white males, are subject to this control. The limit on their free speech are growing ever more severe, and no one has to be concerned about white heterosexual males being offended by offensive or threatening speech. White males can be called anything, and they are. By splintering the working class into victim groups, identity politics has made opposition to war and income inequality impossible. In place of unity, identity politics has dismembered the working class and directed its energies into internal disputes. We now have the fist fights in London's Hyde Park between radical feminists and transgender activists. And it goes on from there. A different point of view than what we're used to. Now, I'm going to play the final part of this series I started last week on consumerism as one of the things that drives capitalism. And if we just simply stop buying all of their stuff, we would be doing ourselves a big favor. So we would be not creating the debt and the stress from that debt, but also we'd be taking power away from them. Tomorrow we'll have Elizabeth McCormick on. She will be having your emails. You can send your emails, questions, comments, and statements that you'd like read on the air or addressed on the air to prnstudio@gmail.com. prnstudio@gmail.com. Now to our final part on consumerism.
The really good news is that the technologies already exist to enable us to radically change our individual lifestyles and become more environmentally friendly. The problem is persuading people to make use of them. So I'm on my way to Sutton in Surrey to visit the UK's first and still best known sustainable housing project. Bedzed, the Beddington Zero Energy Development, is sited on reclaimed land. Built 5 years ago, it's designed to show that eco-construction and a green lifestyle can provide a good quality of life and be affordable too. Building materials come from local, renewable or recycled sources. Energy efficiency is an absolute priority. Heat and electricity are fueled by tree waste, and each house has solar panels and triple glazing. Rainwater is recycled. Domestic appliances are water efficient and low energy. And there's a car share scheme that residents really do make use of. Puran Desai co-founded Bedzed and has lived here from the start.
We all had to work incredibly hard to get this project off the ground. And here, you know, we're going quite a long way to creating what is a vision for a one planet living community. I think within 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you know, we will see very energy efficient homes fitted with energy efficient appliances, many more with some level of integrated renewable energy generation, whether that's solar panels or hot water, solar hot water panels or wood heating systems, or even perhaps some wind turbines on the roof. So, you know, we will see many more of them being incorporated. But we also got to remember that actually, you know, it is our whole lifestyle that counts. And for instance, if you live here and take one overseas, you know, trip to Australia, one flight to Australia, it's as much as 8 years of carbon savings here. You know,
one return flight to Australia.
Yeah,
bloody hell. Even I'm a bit surprised by that.
Yeah, so you start getting the scale of the issues. So, we have to think about our whole lifestyles. We can't just think about energy-efficient homes or, you know, sustainable food or increasing recycling. We have to think of it in a much more holistic way.
Yeah. 4 or 5 years ago, Bedzed was a real pioneer, and it's still very inspirational today. There hasn't been a lot of progress since then, however, not many new developments of this kind. But things are now beginning to change. With rising energy prices, growing awareness about climate change, people have got the message. The truth is, however, that every new housing development, like this one here, is going to have to achieve the same levels of energy efficiency and of low consumption lifestyles as Bedzed.
As the world's resources become scarcer and energy becomes much more expensive, developments like Bedzed are going to make economic as well as ethical sense. New, much more efficient technologies are not the crackpot thinking of green zealots. New, much more efficient technologies are not the crackpot thinking of green zealots. These days, very hard-nosed venture capitalists are piling in with massive new investments to the tune of billions of dollars every year. These technologies are credible, proven alternatives that will save us an enormous amount of money and ward off the most devastating impacts of climate change. But I'm not pretending it's easy. The scale of the problem is enormous, and most of us won't be able to live in a place like Bedsead anytime soon. So, what else can we do? Ironically, help may come from the last place we would expect, some of the world's biggest multinationals. Last year, BP, which for decades has been draining the planet of oil, invited people to find out about their own carbon footprint. That's the amount of carbon dioxide which each of us puts into the atmosphere every year. To their astonishment, more than 400,000 people visited their website. BP's next step was to encourage customers to take more responsibility for their own carbon dioxide emissions from driving. The company calculates how much carbon dioxide is released through the use of your car. Then it asks you to offset the equivalent amount of carbon dioxide by paying a sum of money into a special fund that invests in renewable energy.
You can understand people being a bit cynical about this. What? BP lecturing us about carbon dioxide when it's them that should be in the dock? But just think it through. It's BP and all those other oil companies that produce the petrol and diesel. But we're the ones that use it. These are our emissions from our cars, not BP's. This is about shared responsibility.
The man in charge of BP's carbon offset scheme is Philip New.
What we do is buy or contribute to schemes that will either take carbon out of the atmosphere or substitute, remove carbon that would otherwise have gone into the atmosphere had this scheme not been around. So a great example would be putting in place alternative sustainable energy sources in, for example, India, wind farms and such like. This is not intended to be a simple way of letting people get off the hook and avoid their responsibilities when they drive around. This is about sustainable mobility. But in the long term, it is in our interest and our shareholders' interests, as well as the interests of everyone on the planet, that we start to think about how we can make our cities and our mobility more sustainable.
If scientists are right in their fears about the rapid onset of climate change, then it won't be long before we're living in a world with two currencies, money and carbon. But there's obviously a problem here. If the price we pay for things more accurately reflects its real cost, then won't everything get more expensive? Well, that's true. But that's where technology comes into it, and the potential for serious technology breakthroughs.
Today's economy is still scandalously inefficient in its use of energy, water, and raw materials. Yet the technologies we need already exist, and with massive new investment, they will become both more efficient and cheaper. And that's where we come to the role of government.
There are roughly 22.5 million washing machines in the UK, between them performing about 6 billion washes every year. Now, an inefficient washing machine uses around 100 litres per wash. An efficient one, around 45 litres. So simply moving over from inefficient washing machines to efficient washing machines would save more than half of the 585 billion litres of water that we use in the UK every year just to wash our clothes. So shouldn't EU governments get this sorted out? Instead of relying on a few green consumers, why don't they impose minimum efficiency standards that all manufacturers would have to meet? That's what some people call choice editing, limiting the range of choices available to us so that we can't get our hands on the kind of inefficient, wasteful machines that are still causing such environmental damage today.
But so far, governments the world over have been pathetically poor at driving the kind of efficiency revolution that's required. Could it be that they're still in thrall to the old idea of consumerism?
single most important objective of almost every government today is to maximize economic growth. And politicians know that one of the easiest ways to expand the economy is to persuade people to spend more, consume more, regardless of how deep into debt that gets them. And we're already one of the most indebted nations on earth. So the people on whom we depend most for some alternative, long-term vision are the ones who are most addicted to this short-term consumer fix. And their pursuit of economic growth, as we know it today, reinforces the worst aspects in us, an obsessive desire to consume more in an endless but inevitably forlorn quest for a better life.
But that ends our series on that. We have a lot more sharing on all the programs this week. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
Don't play it no more. Don't play it no more.